Blood circulates around the human body under surprisingly high pressure, enough to produce a 2-meter-high fountain if an artery leaks. And that's exactly what can happen with aneurysms. Swellings caused by a weakening in the arterial wall, which, if left, can eventually burst, leading to life-threatening bleeding. Aneurysms can occur in almost any artery in the body, but the bigger the vessel, the heavier the blood loss, and they don't come any bigger than the aorta, the hosepipe-sized artery leading away from the heart. The aorta arches down through the chest before running into the abdomen, where it divides in two to form the arteries that supply the legs. And it's just above this division, in the abdominal section, that most aortic aneurysms occur. Tricia Burke is vascular nurse specialist at St Mary's Hospital in London.
If you imagine the aorta is like a balloon, but it's a balloon with another balloon inside it, so it's blowing up, but there's a layer in between. So the inside layer will first burst, but it's still held together by the outside. So that's what we would call a leak. So the blood is spurting out, but the aorta hasn't fully burst yet, so it may be contained. And that's the one where we have a little time window. So when that first goes, if you get to us very quickly or you're already in hospital, that's the one that we have the opportunity to fix. If the outside is gone as well, the both layers, that's the one that's really not one that can be survived.
I mean, you can be dead within a couple of minutes. It's like literally like having a hose pipe turned on in your belly.
Not even a couple of minutes. It can be a minute, 30 seconds if it bursts. It's blood that's supposed to be circulating in your body, coming from the heart, that's now just hosing out into your tummy instead of all your blood vessels.
It tends to occur in older people and mostly in men, and that's the standard, more common form of aneurysm.
John Wolfe is one of the consultant vascular surgeons at St Mary's.
It's related to degeneration of the wall, which is related to diet, it's related to smoking and some of those things, but also there is a familial tendency. And there's an unlucky group which can affect both sexes equally, who can be much younger. And that is a disease of the aortic wall that has nothing to do with the degeneration that can happen as you get older.
So these can be, in inverted commas, quite clean living people, but
yes,
still have a problem with,
yes,
with an aneurysm.
Yes.
Looking at your typical clinic that you would run, how do people get to know that they've got an aneurysm? How do they find out?
The most frequent reason nowadays is that they're having some form of test for something else, and it's picked up incidentally during that test, and that's the reason that we pick up more of the aneurysms nowadays. Some people will present with backache, but that's not very many, and some people will actually find that they've got a pulsating lump in their tummy. Some people say, go to their doctor and say their heart slipped because they can feel this pulsating mass in the abdomen
and
the tummy.
Presumably when the aneurysm's fairly extreme.
Yes.
Yeah. So most people will have been picked up by accident, is what you're
yes.
saying, effectively.
Which is why the Department of Health has introduced a new screening program that uses ultrasound scans to pick up aneurysms early enough to do something about them before they rupture, a move that could save 1,500 lives a year. Vascular surgeon Hanny Hafez is director of the screening program at St Richard's Hospital in Chichester.
Mark is now lying on a couch and pulled his shirt up. I'm going to put some gel just above his belly button.
It's essentially the same technology
you
use for looking at a baby.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's exactly the same technology as we use in examining pregnant ladies. What I can see now on the screen is the aorta. And if you look carefully, it's actually pulsating.
Yep. Well, that's my aorta.
That's the aorta. And what we do is we can measure the size.
And a normal aorta would be what sort of size?
A normal aorta in a man would be about 1.8 to 2 centimeters in diameter. And your aorta is 1.6 centimeters in diameter.
Good.
So it's perfectly normal. And it should remain so for many, many more years. Because once we have a normal aorta, the chances of this aorta becoming or having an aneurysm in the future are very, very small.
And in terms of measurement, at what stage would you have started to say, oh, this is looking a bit larger than normal? Where's your cutoff?
At 3 centimeters at the moment. That's what we start to consider as an aorta that would need to be followed up.
So the protocol in the UK is currently what?
To screen men at the age of 65, because from work that's been done before, we know that this is the best age to pick up these aneurysms. If you screen at the age of 75, for example, you found that the incidence of aneurysms have almost tripled, but you would be missing out on a number of aneurysms that have already have caused problems before this age, and that's what we want to avoid. So the safest age to start with is 65, where the majority of aneurysms would be still small, and then you can follow them up. And the frequency of future scans depend on the size. So if the size of the aneurysm initially is in between 3 and 4.5 centimeters, then they need a scan every year. If it is above 4.5 centimeters and less than 5.5 centimeters, they need a scan every 3 months, because the growth of an aneurysm accelerates as the aneurysm gets bigger.
Many patients have already benefited from the pilot screening program at Chichester. Tony Hoskins is one of them.
It turned out that I had got a moderate aneurysm and was told to come back at yearly intervals so that they could keep an eye on it. About a year later, he decided that it had enlarged sufficiently to have surgical treatment, and I was fitted up to go into hospital in November to have the operation. Having made such a remarkable recovery, I find myself now, only a few months after the aneurysm operation, going for reasonably lengthy walks on the downs. I think it is a wonderful idea, and I only hope that as many people as possible will be restored to health as I have been.
Not all aneurysms will grow big enough to warrant treatment.
So if you come in and have a normal scan at 65, do you need to come back again?
You don't need to come back again.
What about women?
Women do develop aneurysms, but they're much less likely than men. The risk in a man is about 6 times more than it is in a woman to develop an aneurysm. They also develop aneurysms at a later age. There's about even 10 years difference in age for women and men. But certainly this is something that we have to revisit in the future.
This is an evidence-based decision. And my practice in Gloucestershire was one of the early ones for looking at the pilot for this. What is the evidence that this intervention is useful? First of all, give me some idea of the proportion of men at 65 who might have a problem.
It's about 3% of men aged 65 will turn out to have an aneurysm.
And if we left those three men, in other words, we didn't scan them, we didn't know they had a problem, what would be the likely outcome?
The likely outcome varies, because we don't know yet how to tell the difference between an aneurysm that will grow to require treatment and an aneurysm that will grow very, very slowly and will not. So we have no choice but to follow all of these aneurysms up. The chances of a person with an aneurysm at the age of 65 having an operation is probably about 30 to 50% in due course, usually over a period of about 5 to 10 years. Depends on the size of the aneurysm at the initial scan.
So roughly half will need surgery that you pick up.
Very roughly.
Presumably that's because those same half, if left, would rupture.
Precisely, yes.
Until screening is more widely available, and it's likely to take at least 5 years to roll it out over England alone, most people with aneurysms will be blissfully unaware of the potential time bomb ticking away in their tummy. Some will be picked up incidentally during investigations for other problems, but for many, the first sign of trouble is when they rupture. And that's often too late. Surgeon John Wolfe again.
The situation is extremely serious, and unlike elective aneurysms, we've not made a great deal of progress in doing better. With elective aneurysms, our ability to get patients through the operation and reduce the risks has got dramatically better over the last decade or so.
Yes. Is there a certain size that the aneurysm has to get to? Or?
Yes, and I mean, fortunately, we're very lucky. We've got some very large studies with very, very good data on this now. And I think we can, with some confidence, leave aneurysms until they're 5.5 centimeters with the knowledge that below that level they really aren't dangerous. And at about 5.5 centimeters, then we do need to consider surgery. And in the majority of patients would operate, but that also depends on the general problems that the patient has other than the aneurysm, of course. For ruptured aneurysms, a lot of the patients don't even get to hospital because obviously it's a major blood vessel, and as soon as the blood starts pouring out of that, they can die very quickly. If they get to hospital, then the operation still carries approximately a 50% mortality rate. And that is more to do with the state of the patient when you start the procedure than it is to do with the procedure itself. The procedure itself is very similar to the one we do electively, except you have to do it quite quickly. But the problem is that you're starting off with a patient who may already have had a cardiac arrest. They may not have any urine coming from their kidneys. They're very, very sick before you start the procedure.
Because of a catastrophic blood loss.
A catastrophic blood loss, yes.
And to put that into perspective, they might lose, how much blood can they lose internally?
Well, they can lose their whole circulating volume, in which case then they won't survive. Or a bit less, in which case we might be able to do something about it.
Definitely people who come in a planned scenario do better. You know, they're psychologically prepared for it. And we've had the opportunity to optimise them beforehand. So we've checked your heart, checked your kidneys, checked your lungs, and done everything we can possibly to make sure you're fit and healthy to undergo the procedure. If in an emergency scenario, we don't have that opportunity to optimise your health, so you will go to the intensive care, you'll be kept asleep, your kidneys, if they had disease that we didn't know about, might take longer to recover. Similarly, your lungs, particularly in smokers, we would always encourage people to stop smoking before an operation. So people that come in an emergency scenario, they tend to take longer to get through the intensive process, and then also the longer process afterwards.
Of course, they might have had a period of sustained low blood pressure before they came in when they were unconscious as an emergency, and that can have knock-on effects on other parts of the body.
Absolutely, the kidneys, the brain, the legs, you know, lots of different problems, and, you know, obviously they're more at risk of complications.
Could you give me some idea of how the emergencies present, what they actually look like when they get here? Presumably they're pretty poorly.
Yeah, very much so. So if... sometimes they're awake, sometimes they're not, depending on how long it's taken them to get to us. Usually a typical presentation will be a collapse, either with some sudden back pain, which is quite a sudden presentation. You'll feel it for a couple of minutes, but if the aneurysm has burst, it's very quick until you collapse. They'll be brought to us usually unconscious, very low blood pressure, and it's a very, very dangerous time. I mean, time is really of the essence in that scenario. So very, very quickly into the accident and emergency unit. And if we know it's an aneurysm, we'll take them straight to the operating theatre.
Presumably, if the patient's unconscious, they can't tell you what's happened to them. So you're going purely by the clinical signs that you're seeing. You have a high index of suspicion.
Definitely. I mean, we do have certain tools. I mean, there are like fast scanners in the accident and emergency unit where we can do quick ultrasounds. If there's blood in the belly, it's a good indicator. Usually they'll need to be opened anyway in that sort of a scenario.
So to find out what's
we going. Find what's in there. If they're stable enough, if their blood pressure is holding and we have, say, 10 minutes to play with, that we can take them to the CT scanner and get much more detailed information, it allows us a better opportunity as to what we may do.
Of course, this is major surgery, and some patients won't go home at all. What are the differences in survival rates?
It depends on how long it takes to get to us. If an aneurysm bursts when you're outside of the hospital environment, statistically, there's about an 80% mortality in that scenario. So about 80% of people do not survive a rupture whatsoever. That's whether they get to hospital or not. If you rupture in a hospital, your rate is anywhere between 40 to 70%, even within a hospital. Here in our hospital, our mortality rate for ruptures is less than 10%. So if you get to us in time, you've got a good chance, but it's the getting to us. It's, you know, somebody finding you collapsed. If you're at home by yourself and your aneurysm bursts, unfortunately, it's unlikely you would get to us in time.
There are two approaches to dealing with an aneurysm: the conventional open operation through a large incision in the abdomen, or the newer keyhole technique where surgeons go in through the groin. John Wolfe.
Well, if we use the open technique, which is a well-tried technique that's been used for 45, 50 years, then we take a piece of Dacron, which is a form of nylon, and it's in the form of a tube, and we sew that in to the area of the aorta that has degenerated and become an aneurysm. And that's just sewn in with a piece of proline, which is like strong fishing line, on a standard stitching technique, and that's a conceptually a very straightforward thing to do. The problem with it is that you have to block the aorta in order to do it, and therefore you put pressure on the heart. And of course you had the added problem that you've had to do a large cut in the abdominal wall in the tummy in order to do the procedure in the first place.
How long does it take for you to perform that operation in theatre?
About 2 hours.
And that involves opening the patient with a vertical incision?
Yes.
And then going right down to that, because the aorta sits at the back in
That's
front of
right.
the spine.
So the patient takes quite a long time to recover. If you use the endovascular technique, that's the what you would probably call the keyhole technique, then the procedure can be done through the groin, and using a fairly fat plastic cannula, you can insert the graft in through the groin. And one, again, it's a form of nylon Dacron, but it's thinner, and therefore it can be squished into this cannula and passed up through the groin. And in order for it to come open in the correct place, it's got metal struts in place within that Dacron that spring open rather like an umbrella once it's inside and in the correct position to be deployed.
And we've got one here. I mean, it's an inch and a bit across. You'd never imagine you'd be able to get that into the groin, but of course it all scrunched up. Reminds me of one of those tents that you can pull out of the bag and it instantly erects itself.
That's a very good analogy, actually. That's a very good analogy.
And that just remains fixed inside. So actually the aneurysm's still there. You're just laying this on the inside to take the pressure off it.
Yes, and I mean, and if you think about it, providing you've got a solid area of aortic wall, like a good area of hose pipe, then the fact that it's degenerated in between and been replaced by a piece of piping is all you require, because you're taking the pressure off that area that is ballooning up, and therefore you're taking pressure off the balloon and it won't burst.
You're unlucky if you need to have one aortic aneurysm repaired, but this patient on the ward along the corridor at St Mary's was recovering from his second. Both aneurysms were picked up in time, albeit accidentally.
The first time it was an open surgery. Mm-hmm. I went to the hospital for something else and they discovered that I had an aneurysm. Mm-hmm. And he said to me, quickly, get up and go and see your doctor.
So, and then 24 hours later, you were having major surgery?
Yes. I recovered very quickly, okay, very quickly. And I think it was, I know it was more hurtful and everything, but I recovered successful.
That was an open one, so you had
yes.
a big sort of...
Very big, yes.
10, 12-inch scar down
yes,
the front of
yes.
your tummy.
I mean,
but had you ever heard of aneurysms
never,
before?
No. Never.
And they presumably replaced the damaged bit with
yes.
a bit of pipe work.
Yes.
Yeah. And that was how long ago?
10 years, exactly.
10 years ago.
Exactly on the day when I came back again for this one.
So what happened that meant you needed more surgery?
For this one.
Mm.
The same thing again. I went for a different story, and they took us back, and the doctor sat us down, and she said to us, I'm sorry, I have to tell you, Mr. Angeli, that your aneurysm is back.
It's not many years ago that the only procedure was an open procedure, and it wasn't until the mid-90s that really people started doing endovascular repairs of aneurysms. And the technology involved with that is evolving very rapidly. So at the moment, I think I would say that the jury is still out on whether it's safer and better to do an endovascular repair in somebody who's a bit younger. In an older person, then there are clear advantages in the short term if you do an endovascular repair, because of the risks of quite a major open operation. But in a younger person, at the moment, that seems to be counterbalanced by some of the longer term problems with the endovascular repair, simply because it's a newer technique. And as the technology changes, so we are able to overcome some of the difficulties, but nevertheless, there are still areas where improvements need to be made with the endovascular technique, and therefore in a younger patient, some of us would be less confident about suggesting an endovascular graft because of the uncertainty in the long-term future.
And in good vascular units like the one at St Mary's, planned repairs have now become fairly routine, with at least a 95% success rate. But it's still a big operation to recover from. Vascular nurse specialist Tricia Burke.
If you have the traditional sort of open repair, probably about a week, maybe 10 days, just depending on the age and the general fitness of the patient. And then with the less invasive surgery, like the stent grafts, usually can be anywhere between 4 to 6 days. But again, depending on the fitness of the patient.
And the emergency is that little bit longer in each case?
Yeah, and that very much depends on how long they take to get off the intensive care unit. Once they're off intensive care, you can kind of gauge, but it's that hit that they take in the emergency scenario.
What about once the patient gets home, everything's gone according to plan, what sort of follow-up do these patients need?
Again, that will depend on the type of operation you have. We'll see everybody in the outpatient clinic because people who have aneurysms have cardiovascular disease. So we'll always be checking for other things and for new aneurysms. But if we will always scan your aorta. So if you've had the old-fashioned operation, we'll scan it every couple of years just to check for new ones. But with stent grafts, you have regular CT scans because, again, we haven't taken away the damaged part of the aorta. We've just reinforced it from the inside. So we need to always check that that stays how it should be and that there's no leaks or anything. So in those patients, they will come every 6 months initially for a CT scan and then every year.
But once the patient has made it home, the outlook is pretty good. Most of the dangers is around the operation.
It's the biggest danger period for them, yes. So generally those that go home do very, very well.
Aortic aneurysms may be the biggest type you can get, but much smaller aneurysms, just a few millimetres across, can be just as lethal if they rupture in a confined space like the skull. At least 1 million people in Britain are walking around with an intracranial aneurysm. The majority occur in women who will never know they have a problem as long as the aneurysm remains intact, as most do. But the outlook is very different if it bursts. Andy Clifton is a consultant neuroradiologist at St George's Hospital in London, where he treats intracranial aneurysms.
A person will be walking along the street. Sometimes it's provoked by exercise, sudden exertion, and it'll be like somebody's worst headache they've ever had, somebody hitting on the back of the head with a sledgehammer. They will perhaps vomit, they'll collapse, go into coma, or you may just get the bad headache and get a very stiff neck and photophobia. When that happens, obviously the thing to do is to dial 999 and get yourself down to your nearest casualty.
So the classic symptom of a burst intracranial aneurysm would be a sudden onset headache, and depending on how severe the bleed, you know, everything from that right through to full unconsciousness. These people arrive in hospital. What happens next?
Right. Very serious condition. 25% of patients, despite treatment, will die before they get to hospital. At the end of a series of treatments, 25% will have a relatively normal life, and the other 50% will vary from being heavily dependent to being able to live a relatively normal life.
And what sort of people are more likely to develop these intracranial aneurysms?
Well, there's a female preponderance. So between 60 and 70% of patients will be female. If you actually have got an aneurysm, we know that there's a higher risk, perhaps 2 to 1, of the aneurysm bursting or the effects being worse if you smoke, and also high blood pressure has about a 1.5% risk.
So these bleeds can be pretty catastrophic. How big are these aneurysms that are bursting?
You're talking the average size of the ones I treated from 2 millimetres, which is very small, up to about 1 centimetre. And put that in perspective, if you look at the diameter of one of our pennies, that's actually 2 centimetres. Studies have also shown, particularly a large one from the Mayo Clinic in the States, that aneurysms under a 5-6 millimetres have a very, very low risk of rupture, perhaps less than 0.1% a year. So most patients will carry on with their aneurysm, not knowing they've got it there, and they'll die of something else, such as heart disease or stroke or cancer, which are the commonest causes of death.
But presumably it's not the size of the aneurysm that matters, it's the size of the bleed.
Exactly.
They can produce large volumes of blood, which presumably presses on the brain, surrounding brain.
What it does is burst into the subarachnoid space. That's the space where the blood vessels live, where our brain fluid is. It increases the pressure dramatically on the surrounding brain structures, and that's why the patient feels so unwell.
It was a Sunday morning, and I was playing in a tennis match at my local club, and as I reached up to serve, I felt a sudden ping in my head, which was like a thick elastic band snapping, and then I suddenly became quite weak.
Lauren Downey's aneurysm burst when she was 48.
I started getting very shaky, and I put my hand up to stop the game and call the others over to the net. And as I walked to the net, I realised my body was going into shock, and the pain was absolutely excruciating.
Headache?
Yeah, really unbelievable. My friends helped me into the clubhouse, and all the light had become extraordinarily bright. My senses had completely changed in an instant. My neck had gone really, really stiff, and I felt like I was going to be very, very sick in no time. I said, my dad died of a brain hemorrhage, and I think I'm having one. And they all looked at me completely aghast and in shock, unable to know what to do.
Lauren's aneurysm was treated using a keyhole approach, the type of procedure performed by neuroradiologists like Andy Clifton.
Patient stabilised. The next thing to do is to seal off the aneurysm.
So conventional approach would be to open the brain and clip or tie off that bleeding vessel.
That's right.
But you're going in through the artery. So how do you gain access to the artery?
Under general anaesthetic, because if you're talking about 2 millimetre aneurysms, it's very, very sort of intricate stuff. And if the patient moved more than about 2 millimetres, the aneurysm might burst. So the patient's got to be very still. What I do is put a needle into the artery in the leg, the femoral artery, and then feed a tube or a catheter up into the target vessel, which is usually one of the vessels in the neck. We then use using special road mapping. It's a bit like your TomTom, but in the brain. I feed a very fine catheter into the aneurysm, and then through that very fine catheter, we've got various sort of tricks. We've got balloons, we've got stents, but usually we just use coils until the aneurysm solidly packed and excluded from the circulation. Once it's excluded from the circulation, it can't bleed again.
And the success rate for that sort of procedure?
Usually about 98%.
I think it was Tuesday morning, I came round and sat up in bed, and my sister was there with my mother, and they told me I'd had a brain operation, and I thought they were all making it up. I couldn't make sense of anything.
It was all a bit surreal.
Totally surreal.
Now, how long ago was that?
That was 4 years.
I mean, looking at you now, it looks like you made a complete recovery.
I've been very fortunate.
Have you been left with any form of deficit that you've noticed?
No, I've been told that I haven't, but you never quite
know,
do you?
Well, it's one thing being told you haven't. But a lot of people complain of quite subtle changes, but you've not noticed anything.
Yes, there were loads, and they've taken quite a long time to overcome.
Things like?
Like concentration and actually being able to accept the situation and realise that you had to take it easy and actually listen to your brain.
Lauren Dorney, who has made an excellent recovery from her brain hemorrhage in 2004. If you'd like to hear any part of the programme again, then do visit the website at bbc.co.uk/radio4. Next week's programme is all about the kidney, including why blood in your urine is a serious symptom that should never be ignored.
Case Notes was presented by Dr. Mark Porter. The producer was Erica Wright. You can download this programme as a podcast from the Radio 4 website, where you can also ask for the programme to be sent to your MP3 player every week.